Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What gives political cartoons their unique ability to get a rise out of us, and why do we tend to remember them long after specific headlines fade from memory? My guest today is not an artist, but a self-described word person who, as longtime editor and publisher of The Nation, once published a cartoon that caused his entire staff to sign a protest document. And in the nearly 30 years since then, Victor S. Navasky has remained fascinated by the extraordinary ability of political cartoons to convey ideas and to speak truth to power. Victor Navasky is now director of the Delacorte Center for Magazine Journalism at Columbia University and chair of the Columbia Journalism Review. He explores the influence of cartoons over the centuries in his new book, The Art of Controversy: Political Cartoons and Their Enduring Power. Victor, welcome to Think.
It's good to be here.
So tell us a little bit about this now legendary David Levine cartoon that you published in 1984.
Sure. I was sitting in my office at The Nation, and one day the phone rang, and it was the great caricaturist David Levine, who did regular caricatures for the New York Review of Books. And the phone rang, and it was David, and he said, "Listen, he had a caricature of Henry Kissinger, but it was too strong for New York Review to run, and were we interested?" And he said, "Let me describe it to you." And I said, "Of course, David, we're interested in anything you do." He said, "Well, let me describe it. It shows Kissinger on top and the world in the form of a woman on bottom, and under an American flag blanket, Kissinger is screwing the world." I said, "David, I'm very interested, but it's going to get me in a lot of trouble." And he said, "Why?" I said, "I don't know, but I know it will." About 2.5 hours later, the cartoon arrived in our office. I looked at it, and it showed Kissinger with his horn-rimmed glasses and this exquisite look on his face, which combined ecstasy and evil as he was doing his dirty business under the American flag blanket. And I sent it through to be published. I called David. I said, "We're very excited about it." And then about an hour after that, a petition landed on my desk, signed by 25 people in an office that I had thought employed only 23 people, objecting to our publishing the cartoon, with little side notes saying sexist or why isn't he doing it to a third world male. We had a meeting about it. I invited David to come in, and we published the cartoon, and it went on to, in effect, win awards and end up being on the front page of a catalog when an exhibit of cartoons traveled to Harvard.
So it was ultimately vindicated, but it took a while.
Yes.
And you actually, I want to talk more about this. You brought David Levine in to talk with your staff, and he was there sort of grilled for 2 hours. And at the end of it, he tells you, "I love that."
Yes, I asked him if he was sorry he came, and he said that he wasn't sorry because he had been doing this for 25 years and he had never had a discussion about his work. But the discussion showed him no deference. I mean, one of the young women in the office, her main objection was that The Nation magazine is supposed to be against stereotypes, and this cartoon, this caricature, reinforces the stereotype that sex is something that an active male on top does to a passive woman on bottom. And David said all the wrong things, by the way, in an office with five self-declared gay people. He said, "I'm just showing what normal people do." And he said, "Yes, it does reflect a stereotype, but caricature draws on stereotypes. And that's one of the complications. How do you do it without reinforcing the stereotype, but nevertheless play off of it and exploit it to make your statement?"
How do you know a good cartoon when you see it?
Say it again, I'm sorry?
How do you know a good cartoon when you see it?
I mean, I think it's the Supreme Court Justice, what was it, Potter Stewart, who was talking about obscenity, and he said, "I know it when I see it." I don't think there are simple rules, but it's a combination of, you've got to recognize, if it's a caricature, you've got to recognize the subject, but it also carries a message, and it can't be in the subject's own image. It's a message about the subject. And one of the kind of frustrating things about great cartoons is that they're unfair because they exaggerate by definition, and they And if you don't like an editorial that is written about you or someone you care about, you can write a letter to the editor disputing the facts in it, even if it's only in your own head. But if you don't like a caricature that is done of yourself or someone that you care about, there is no such thing as a cartoon to the editor or a caricature to the editor unless you happen to be a caricaturist yourself.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about this, though, since this book came into our offices. And now that so much political discourse has been sort of reduced to this stereotyped, hyperbolic discourse where there isn't a lot of nuance, suddenly cartoons don't seem so very shocking as they used to.
Well, you know, when the thing happened with the Kissinger cartoon at The Nation, at first I thought it was just another example of the left, and The Nation is a magazine that has mostly people who identify with radical, progressive left politics. I thought it was another example of the left obsessing over political correctness. But what didn't occur to me was the obvious thing was it was partly that, but it was partly the fact that it was done in visual language rather than a verbal language. Mm. And it wasn't until the Danish cartoonists, remember, a dozen Danish cartoonists were commissioned to do caricatures or cartoons about Muhammad when a children's book writer couldn't find a Danish cartoonist willing to draw Muhammad because they thought the Quran forbid it. And hundreds of thousands of Muslims took to the streets. Embassies were closed down. Goods were boycotted. Prices were put on the cartoonists' heads. And so the visual language can, on certain occasions, get people much more emotionally involved and agitated than mere words, even though cartoons and caricatures for years have been dismissed by serious art critics as trivial and silly and not serious and not worthy of serious artistic attention. And so I then started to go back in time, and I discovered that the great artist Daumier was thrown into prison for mm-hmm. his caricature of King Louis Philippe, and that's where the book came from.
Why do you think, going back to the Danish cartoons, why do you think that those cartoon images ultimately sparked more sometimes violent outrage than the release of real traceable photos of prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib?
Well, there is a woman named Maria Adato who wrote a book about photographs. I spoke to her about this. And she says, you know, there are some things that are just the act itself is profane and is regarded as a violation, as a prohibition. A lot of the people who objected to the Danish cartoons, by the way, never actually saw them. But it was the idea of them that was incendiary. And it's like burning the Ku Klux Klan, burning a cross on one's lawn. Mm. Something that if you do it, it's an act of violence to the people who feel it that way.
Did you try to obtain a copy to publish in the book? They don't appear there.
I had copies, but what I say in the book about it was when I started this project, I had read an editorial in the New York Times about the Danish Muhammad caricatures in which they said there was no need for the New York Times, to publish them because we don't, as a matter of routine, publish things that are offensive to some of our readers. And besides, you could describe the cartoons in words, so you didn't have to see them, and you could find them on the Internet. And I, at the time, thought that was wrong because you have to experience the best of these caricatures, like the Kissinger one. You have to experience it. Rather, you can't describe that in words. The great British caricature, Ralph Steadman, says, in fact, that caricature is something that you can't put into words. Hmm. And so when I set out to do this, I thought I would republish the Danish Muhammads. But my publisher was partly concerned that they still had this power to attract violence, and that booksellers would be afraid to carry the book, and that, indeed, people might put bombs in bookstores, that Amazon might not put it online, that they had a whole series of questions about it. And I then began to ask myself, who am I to put the lives of book sales people at risk? And in fact, you can find these all over the internet, and they're not very great cartoons anyway. So what I did in the book is I gave the reader an assignment. I said, these cartoons do not appear here, A, because you can find them anyplace else on the internet, B, because they're not very good anyway, C, because the publisher doesn't want to publish them, D, because booksellers may be afraid to carry them, E, because I found a great cartoon about the controversy itself by a French cartoonist named Plantu, who does regular cartoons and caricatures for Le Monde, a great newspaper published in France. And his cartoon showed an artist's hand and a pen. And the pen was saying, the artist's hand was drawing the following sentence, I must not draw Muhammad, I must not draw Muhammad. And he draws this sentence 100 times, and by the time he's finished drawing it 100 times, he's done a portrait of Muhammad. So he sort of captured the great contradictions in this injunction. And it seemed to me that that sort of said it all. In any event, so I listed all of these choices, including Plantus is better, and then A, B, C, D, E, F, and then G, all of the above, and then I said correct answer, all of the above. So that's why those cartoons don't appear in here, but you can find them on the internet.
And you know, to describe the images, they're not, I mean, it, obviously, if one has a religious sensitivity to the imagery, they would be upsetting. But I think when you describe them in words, it's hard for some observers, some listeners to understand what all the fuss was about.
Well, they are not just portraits of Muhammad or caricatures. They're statements about him. For example, the one I found the most the best of the lot, and again, they're not so executed in a way that suggests that there were Daumiers or Levines among those artists, but the one that spoke to me most directly showed Muhammad with where his turban was a sort of hydrogen bomb growing out of his turban, and which basically said that Muslims are terrorists, and of course some Muslims are terrorists, and most Muslims aren't. And so people objected on that ground. But another thing that was discovered by a writer named Clausen, who is a professor up in New England, she did a book about the episode that the Yale University Press published. Also, by the way, did not include the caricatures because the press was worried about it. And she pointed out that one of the things that happened was that people who were upset about the idea of the cartoons dispatched some folks who took examples of them to leaders of the Muslim world, and they included in the examples some pictures that were not in the original set that the cartoonist did. For example, one with Muhammad's genitals showing. And so these depictions outraged the people who saw them, and they were not part of the original batch of cartoons anyway.
Yeah.
So the whole thing was a massive political act.
Victor Navasky is my guest. His new book is called The Art of Controversy, Political Cartoons and Their Enduring Power. You can join the conversation now at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Victor Novasky, former publisher and editor of The Nation, now director of the Delacorte Center for Magazine Journalism and chair of the Columbia Journalism Review. His new book is called The Art of Controversy, Political Cartoons and Their Enduring Power. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Victor, this book is an amazing reminder that some of the most celebrated artists in Western history have tried their hands at caricature, people like Picasso and Goya and Bernini. Can you talk about what the appeal was, even for those artists who were far better known for other forms and other genres?
Well, without pretending to go into the mind of Picasso or those folks, the great art critic named Ernst Gombrich said the caricaturist is in the business of, and this is a quote, mythologizing the world by physiognomizing it, which translates to mean that the caricaturist creates the fusion, that amalgam that seems so convincing to the emotional mind, and points out you can call a cabinet minister a parasite, but to make the charge visually, as in James Gilroy's famous print of Prime Minister William Pitt as a toadstool growing out of the crown, is something else again. Mm-hmm. And I think that these great artists were, they had statements that they wanted to make, and they could only make them visually. And as I said earlier, that you can't, it's like poetry, you can't paraphrase a great poetry and explain it, and you can't describe it. You got to see it to appreciate what they thought, and they could only express themselves visually, and I think that that's why they did it, and in effect, they couldn't help themselves, that was their way of self-expression, and many of them suffered greatly for it. Some of them were sued for hundreds of millions of dollars. Some went to prison, as Daumier did. The greatest Palestinian cartoonist of his time was shot on the streets of London. They're still debating whether the Israelis did it or Arafat did it, because he attacked both of them. He was an equal opportunity offender, and he was murdered. And there's a story that's just out on the internet today about a cartoonist, Ali Firzat, in Syria, who was had three people assaulted him, dragged him out of his car, and put handcuffs on his wrists so that he couldn't draw his cartoons of Assad. And people just get so upset by this method of communication. That's part of it.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about the power of visual images, because clearly they have an emotional content that is hard to reproduce even in great writing, unless you have a subject who comes to this with the time and the attention. They also, as Martin Luther discovered, have a power to influence people who might not read very well or at all.
Yes. Maybe the most famous line ever uttered about a cartoonist was Boss Tweed in New York, who said of the great cartoonist Thomas Nast, he used to do regular caricatures of him, "I don't give a damn what they write about me, but get rid of those goddamn pictures," he said. "My constituents can't read, but they all see these pictures," and these pictures showed him as a greedy, fat, boss who, and ironically, when he finally was apprehended in Spain, where he had fled to evade the law, it was by people who had seen caricatures of him that Thomas Nast had drawn. And so it's not just, Martin Luther understood the power of these things. It was a class matter at that point, that a lot of people who couldn't read could see the pictures. But even in literate society, there's a sort of group effect. When a group, it's a public act to have a cartoon in a way that writing is not quite, because people see it simultaneously, and it speaks to the emotional mind. There was a great cartoonist, Art Young, who was doing things for the Masses magazine in at the time of the First World War. And he and his fellow editors at the Masses were indicted for conspiracy under the Espionage Act to obstruct the draft for the cartoons that the paper ran. And he did one of his most famous cartoons was a reward poster for, it showed a picture of Jesus Christ, and on top it says reward, and if you read what it says under, it says wanted for sedition, criminal anarchy, vagrancy, and conspiring to overthrow the established government. And then it goes on from there, and said to be a carpenter by trade, etc. So you can do things in that form that you can't quite do in just conventional prose. And and then there are cartoonists like the late Herb Bloch, who gave Nixon his 5 o'clock shadow. And I think that Nixon's 5 o'clock shadow shadowed him throughout his career, as it were, and helped bring him down during the Watergate scandal.
So Hitler was famously fastidious about trying to control all the media. He had limited success in keeping a lid on images that portrayed him. He wasn't bothered by being portrayed as a tyrant, but he hated to be portrayed as an idiot.
Yes, I think that's true. He had a feeling for cartoons in the sense that he commissioned one of his propaganda ministers commissioned a set of cartoons to answer the cartoons that were critical of him. But he also, during his regime, there was this magazine, Der Stürmer, which would run weekly caricatures, vicious, ugly, anti-Semitic caricatures of drooling, greedy, hook-nosed Jews that set the image for the Jew throughout that period in Germany. And it's interesting that at the Nuremberg trials, the only person who was condemned to death, he was hanged and cremated, who wasn't a member of the high command, in effect, was Jules Streicher, who owned Der Stürmer magazine, which every week published these vicious caricatures. And I think there was an understanding by the tribunal of the emotional power they had.
You know, and it's interesting when you say established the image of the Jew during that period in Germany, because it does seem that when a particularly influential artist or cartoon or series of caricatures is out there, then everyone who comes after goes to that visual language in order to sort of dialogue with the original work.
Yes, I mean, I think it's hard to... for example, to think of Joe McCarthy without thinking of the tar brush that Herb Bloch put in his hand. I mentioned the 5 o'clock shadow of Nixon, and Nixon may be a bad example because the great caricaturist Doug Marlette, who was a cartoonist, he used to do things regularly for Newsweek at the end of his career, excuse me, for Newsday newspaper at the end of his career, once said of Richard Nixon that Nixon was to cartoonists what Marilyn Monroe was to sex. He looked like his policies. His nose told you he was going to invade Cambodia.
I want to go back for a minute and talk some more about Thomas Nast, who, as you mentioned, sort of helped to bring down Tammany Hall and Boss Tweed. He gave us the visual shorthand for the Republican and Democratic parties. Today, the parties embrace these symbols. Were they fond of them at the time?
You know, it's a very good question. I don't know the answer to it, but they accepted them. They accepted them. I mean, the Democratic donkey and the Republican elephant are still with us. He also gave the culture Santa Claus, and the rosy-cheeked, bearded Santa Claus was his image. So caricatures and cartoonists can capture a cultural moment or an appropriate symbol, as well as make a devastating political comment. The thing that is peculiar is when you get someone, or unusual, when you get someone who can do them all at once at the same time. And Nast, with his Who Stole the People's Money cartoon, which shows Boss Tweed and all of the members of the Tammany Hall ring, each pointing at the other one in a circle, it captures the corruption that was endemic at the time in a way that, again, that words just couldn't do.
So there is the content of the cartoons, the ideas behind them, the visual sort of punch of seeing them portrayed in an image. You also did some investigation into the sort of neuroscience behind why cartoons have such an impact on us. Can you talk about what you learned?
Yes. I first consider a number of different explanations of why these cartoons have power. The obvious one is the content of the message. That doesn't, however, explain why cartoons have more power than words. And the second one is images themselves, which through history have had a special emotional power. And you go back to the Old Testament, no graven images. And so it's a combination of content and images. But also, if you think of the cartoon as the image and the content, if you think of it as the stimulus, then and you think of the response as what happens in the human brain, then it becomes just a psychological event. And there is this whole complicated field of neuroscience which does its best to explain how the human brain works. And there's even now a subfield called neuroaesthetics, which purports to explain how pictures work. And a number of experiments have been done. They are too crude for my taste to explain anything specifically, but they touch on something that I think is profoundly true. For example, one of them is cited by a neuroesthetician named Ramachandran is an experiment where they took herring gull chicks and found that that these chicks fed themselves by, first of all, by pecking on their mother's beak. And their mother had a long beak with a red dot at the end. And the experiment was they substituted for the beak a long stick with more than one red dots at the end. And the longer the stick and the more red dots, the more fervently the herring gull chicks pecked. And what Ramachandran concluded from that was that, that they, to the extent that animals can have emotions, that they got more emotionally involved in this behavioral learning experience through the exaggeration of the stick, and that there was the same kind of exaggeration that cartoonists deploy when they do caricatures. And another experiment along the same lines was a neuroscientist trained rats to avoid squares and respond and rewarded them when they discovered rectangles. And the longer the rectangle, the greater the reward. Again, a caricature of if you think of the rectangle as a caricature of a square. And so they found that there is this emotional activity in the brain as a result of these things. To leap directly from that to why cartoons and caricatures work is, to me, too great a leap. But when you put it together with the content and visual language, the images, you begin to get an understanding of how these things work.
Cartoons, of course, have been a powerful weapon in American politics, starting before the Revolutionary War and on in through that period. Can you talk about that a little bit?
We talk about Nast as for the way he exposed Boss Tweed, but he also, before he got around to doing that, I think Lincoln called him his greatest recruiting sergeant because he did cartoons and caricatures about the period in the country before the Civil War, and so they've always had this role here. But one of the problems that came up in my own research is that even someone like Nast, who is a great Democrat, has been accused of being a racist, not against black people, African Americans, but against the Irish. And if you look at some of his early cartoons, of course, they do run stereotypes of what Irish people were said to have looked like back at that time. And cartoons and caricatures are used not just as symbols for political parties, they are used for recruiting posters, and they draw people in ways that that conventional art does not. And people today think that the cartoonist is an endangered species, because it is true that fewer people today make their living as cartoonists than used to be the case when newspapers were riding highest. But the internet has spawned a whole new set of opportunities for images to work their magic, and both in through animation but also through replication. So I think that this art form is going to be with us for some time to come.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because now you have individuals acting as sort of, you know, curators and disseminators of information that once was only the power rested only with, you know, the editors and publishers of magazines and newspapers.
Right. I mean, you know, it goes all the way back, though, you asked, to Benjamin Franklin, who published the first cartoon in America and in his old Saturday Evening Post, and right up to the present day. So,
Victor S. Novasky is my guest. He is former publisher and editor of The Nation and director of the Delacorte Center for Magazine Journalism. He's also chair of the Columbia Journalism Review. His new book is called The Art of Controversy, Political Cartoons and Their Enduring Power. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. And if you'd like to join us, maybe talk about your most memorable cartoon, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Victor S. Novasky, who is former publisher and editor of The Nation, currently chair of the Columbia Journalism Review, and author of the new book, The Art of Controversy, Political Cartoons and Their Enduring Power. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Victor, I'm curious, does the special power of caricatures and cartoons to spark this great emotion that in some cases leads to action or to a shift in opinion, the fact that those can be, that power can be used for what we consider to be good, or, you know, can really promote some nefarious ideas like anti-Semitism and racism and sexism and that sort of thing, does that complicate your admiration for the art form itself?
It doesn't complicate my admiration for the art form. It increases it. However, it complicates my whole general orientation towards the First Amendment and free speech in the United States. I am a card-carrying member of the American Civil Liberties Union. I've been brought up to believe in the power of the better argument, the idea of Habermas, the great German philosopher, that the way to counter bad speeches with better speech and all of that. And then if it suddenly turns out that one picture, as I say in the frontispiece of the book, I quote the famous phrase, one picture is worth 10,000 words, and I say that if he didn't say it, that it's attributed to Confucius, and I say if he didn't say it, he should have. Because if one picture is worth 1,000 or 10,000 words, that complicates one's ability to think of the importance of words and how you and why they should be free. But in my case, I'm struggling with that, and I believe that pictures should be free as well. The same presumption should apply to them. In fact, the Supreme Court, in a case involving, of all people, Hustler magazine, ruled that cartoons and caricatures were, seemed to rule that they were entitled to the same protections as conventional speech.
It is interesting. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Because they were a form of editorial statement.
Even in this country where, of course, we hesitate considerably before even arguing that anything should be censored. You mentioned Art Spiegelman earlier. There was this piece that he did in 99 with it looks like a New York City police officer at a shooting gallery, sort of taking out targets that look like, you know, a little child with an ice cream cone and an elderly person. Public officials don't hesitate to, if not call for their censorship, at least decry these pieces in a way that maybe they would not speak that way about, say, an editorial that was unfavorable to them.
Well, I think that's right. I think that cartoonists and caricatures are sort of regarded as second-class citizens in the world of print. And I think that's wrong because they are smart, they are courageous, they are talented, and they speak in a different language, but that they shouldn't be underestimated for that.
Are there times when you sense that cartoons are created first and foremost with the intention of being provocative rather than being motivated by any particular emotion or opinion or idea?
Well, sure. There's this whole underground comics movement that came up, started in the 60s, but it's still very much with us. And people like Tom Tomorrow and Dwayne Booth, who does stuff under the pseudonym of Mr. Fish, and others who are, I think they go out of their way to outrage their readers. And Gary Trudeau, I don't think he goes out of his way to outrage his readers, but on a regular basis, this various subscribers to the syndicate won't carry his cartoons. I mean, I think they like to make trouble, but not just for its own sake, but because they want to cause people to stop and think and say, hey, wait a minute, there is an absurdity in this idea, and they glory at showing it.
Is the content, the sentiment of content in cartoons, does it sort of predetermine or does it predict shifts in public opinion? Like, are cartoons, say, unfavorable to a particular administration? Are they the canary in the coal mine before public opinion tends to turn?
I think sometimes they're ahead and sometimes they're not. But if you take someone like, there's a cartoonist in South Africa who does his cartoons under the name of Zapiro, Z-A-P-I-R-O, and he did a cartoon that I use in the book on Jacob Zuma. Mm-hmm. And it shows Zuma, who is, you know, the head of South Africa, and it shows him with a shower, one of these shower things attached to his head and dripping some water coming down. And he famously, at a trial where he was accused of rape, he contended that it was consensual sex, not rape, but that after he had sex with the woman who accused him, he took a shower because as a way to cleanse himself of her HIV infection, which indeed she turned out to have. And so forever after, Zapiro draws him with a shower thing at the top of his head. And it's a running joke, but it's a running comment, so it's impossible to think of him without this weird excuse he gave for how he thinks AIDS works, HIV, and how it spread, and for his attempt to evade responsibility for what on the surface looked like a rape. So it's a way that a cartoonist can have of reminding people in perpetuity of his basic statement. Also, there are cartoons that have an indelible quality. I think, for example, when David Levine did LBJ showing his appendectomy scar mm-hmm. in the form of a
looks like Vietnam.
Vietnam.
Yeah.
That has entered the history books, and that's going to be with us for much longer than David Levine, who is no longer with us. That image.
As an editor, what did you have to think about when publishing a cartoon with regard to the statement it makes about the position of an entire publication?
I took the David Levine's Kissinger cartoon to be a statement about Kissinger's relationship to the world and what his policies were doing to it. But he used as his format to make that statement an image of sexuality, which, as David said, is, he said, what normal people do is what many people do. But I took his statement, the first statement, to have more power. You know, we had this meeting, which I mentioned to you, that David came to. Also at the meeting was Christopher Hitchens, and the great columnist for The Nation, whose own politics moved over the years from being a socialist in the first place to being a real critic of American policy in the second place, and a supporter of the war in Iraq and Iran. And Christopher took the position that what Kissinger was doing was not, as Levine put it, screwing the world, but that he was raping the world. Hmm. And there was a very kind of funny moment, odd moment, when our assistant circulation manager made the point that the same woman who made the point about The Nation shouldn't be in the business of reinforcing this stereotype of sex as something that a male on top active does to a passive woman on bottom. She pointed out that when you looked at Levine's picture of the world, her hand was gripping the mattress. And she said, if you look at her grip on the mattress, the world's grip on the mattress, it looks to me like the grip of passion. And Christopher, who played the officer away, was wearing his white suit, leaned over and grabbed her wrists and said, trust me, my dear, it's not the grip of passion. Well, that's a funny moment in a discussion about a serious matter. So
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Oh, thanks, dear. Yes, you know, I was curious because we had such a strange array of people running for president last year. And one of them, being our governor, involved the editorial cartoonist from the Austin American Statesman, who is Ben Sargent. And this guy, I'm just curious if you had seen his work or not. This guy is one of the most outlandishly talented editorial cartoonists I have ever seen in my life. If not, I would suggest you look him up.
Well, thank you. I've been invited to address the Editorial Cartoonist Convention in Salt Lake City at the end of next month, and I will definitely look them up while I'm there.
Why do you think, Victor, that most cartoonists appear to be and to have been men?
Well, I don't want to, you know, I asked that very question to Frances Jetter, who is a very talented a woman who is a cartoonist and an illustrator. And of course there are others like Sue Coe and Signe Wilkerson and any number of women who are cartoonists. But it's I think part of the patriarchal nature of the workplace over the years. But it's a good question. I don't know the short answer to it. And part of it was self-reinforcing because men were doing it for all those years, and they were also running the show at these newspapers. There are so many talented women artists that they ought to be better represented in the cartooning world. So let's see what happens next.
When you get in a room, and I know you haven't yet been to this conference, but this convention, but when you get in a room full of cartoonists and caricaturists, do they have particular qualities in common that you can observe?
Well, You know, I think there is a sort of clarity of vision that comes from the habit of reducing complicated issues to their most significant point, which is what cartoonists and caricatures frequently do. And I think one of the reasons I think that people get so upset about caricatures is that I had mentioned before that they are almost by definition unfair because they exaggerate one's least attractive quality, but and there's no way to respond to that. But the second reason is the suspicion that the caricaturist or cartoonist may have discovered the ultimate truth about you. Someone once said that, you know, the artist is in the business of discovering the perfect form, and the cartoonist, the caricaturist, is in the business of discovering the perfect deformity. So Bob Grossman, a great cartoonist and caricaturist, both once said that, you know, we're all in the business of assassination. But if you met Bob Grossman, he's the world's sweetest guy. And so if he's in the assassination business, he's a sweet assassin. So they have a clarity of vision, I would say, that for him. Some are quite articulate, like Steve Brodney, and some really only are articulate with the chalk in their hand, the crayon in their hand.
If for a year you were able to trade your gifts as a writer for gifts as a cartoonist, would you do it?
I'll put my answer in the form of a picture.
Where do you go now? What are your favorite sources of interesting cartoons these days?
Well, you know, I'm like other people. I love the New Yorker magazine, and their, you know, their cartoons set a standard that is to be admired. And I also am very interested in illustrations, and you know, the New York Times, for example, as a matter of principle, never has run cartoons, certainly not in the last 75 years, with their editorials. But they have run illustrations on the op-ed page, and I've talked to illustrators, and there was a woman named Jarell Krauss who did her own book called All the Art That's Not Fit to Print. She had worked as an art director on the op-ed page, and she talked about why different images were killed by the powers that be, the editors who oversee the art directors. And there's still this contest that goes on there. It's unresolved, and it's important terrain. And people like me, who are trained to the extent that we were trained at all to be word editors, may not be the best person to make these decisions about the visual language.
Victor Novasky's new book is The Art of Controversy, Political Cartoons and Their Enduring Power. Victor, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, and thanks a lot, and it was good talking with you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.